This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Also sponsored by Windstar Farm. Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is, of course, the show trainers listen to, and we certainly appreciate you being with us tonight and every night as we bring you Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, along with the Pontiff of the Pick 4, Jude Feld. And we do want to extend a special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM Channel 206. And yes, everyone tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer, your smartphone, or your tablet at horseracingradio.net. And JT, we have had the privilege over the past couple of years on this program to visit with so many top trainers, and each of them has a little different story, a little different background, a little different twist to the way that they've reached the levels that they're at now. And quite frankly, we've had the privilege to visit with so many of the top female trainers that we have in the game today, and another top female trainer joining us on the program tonight.
Yeah, very excited about that, and my family goes back a long ways with female trainers. My father had a gal named Mary G. Ellis in the 1950s. She was the only woman to have stalls at Santa Anita, and that was his trainer until I came along. So, it's a great history that my family has with women, and I think it's very important that we cover the women as well as men in our sport.
Well, tonight's guest joins us from the Golden State of California, which is appropriate because she is a California native. She is closing in on 300 career victories. Her win total currently stands at 292. Her runners have earned more than $13 million in purses, bolstered by a host of greatest stakes winners. And she is trainer Kristen Mulhall, and she's with us here tonight on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Kristen, welcome to Trainer Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you on board and looking forward to hearing your story. And, you know, it's interesting when you think about where Kristen Mulhall started, the racetrack has always kind of been home to you, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. My dad was on the racetrack for, well, since I was born, pretty much.
And
He had a
long and storied career. Nobody had stories like your father.
He did have a lot of them. He's been around for a long time and pretty much been everywhere all across the world. Wherever they race horses, he's been there.
Yeah, the daughter of retired longtime Southern California trainer Richard Mulhall, who of course passed away last year. We certainly remember him on this program as well. And Kristen, when you think about your dad and his career, he trained for, what, three decades before moving over to serve as the racing manager to the late Saudi prince Ahmed Salman. What can you tell us about your dad and his operation and his approach to training?
He was, from what I remember, I mean, I was a little tiny girl at the time when I used to go to the barn and everything, but I think I was probably only 8 or 9 when he retired. He was pretty aggressive. He liked to work horses. He liked to work them hard and fast to make sure they were fit. And he was always on my case when he was around that I needed to be harder on him and I needed to run fit horses rather than giving him a race here and there. And we used to always argue, and I used to just tell him that they don't make him as strong as they made him when he was around. He could be pretty hard on one. But, and I was actually heartbroken when he decided to retire and take over with the Thoroughbred Corporation, but then I got the farm and lots of hands-on experience.
Yeah, but your dad didn't really want you to follow in his footsteps, did he?
No, he didn't want me to train, which is funny because he kind of turned the farm over to me and I was able to learn everything with all the layups and how to rehab them all, and I broke probably 30 to 40 yearlings a year. All the Thoroughbred Court babies I broke, Point Given, Spain, Oath, who won the Epsom Derby. I was lucky enough to be able to break all those horses. And he didn't mind that, but the minute I decided to turn over to the racetrack and train, he did not want me anywhere near there.
Well, you know, being a daddy, he knew the pitfalls of the racetrack, and it's not all fun and games like sometimes it seems to people. It can be a pretty tough place, especially for a woman, but you were always a horse person. You rode jumpers and things. You've been around horses your whole life, so it was kind of a natural thing, I think, for a lot of people that work on farms early on. They want to get to the races because the competition is pretty luring.
Yeah, I definitely. I mean, I think the reason he was so upset was because I was doing the show jumpers at the time, and I was very, very successful with them, and I had a very good stable of horses, some top Grand Prix horses and horses that could go to eventually get to the international level. And I mean, I was sitting on very, very, very good stock, and I injured my arm and wasn't able to show for about 6 months and missed a huge competition and kind of broke my heart a little bit and hung around the racetrack and just never left. But I think he had a hard time me walking away from those horses knowing what my future could have been in the show horse world.
Your arm injury that you just mentioned, Kristen, was somewhat of a fluke thing, wasn't it? Having punctured it, what, on a nail in a tack room? Is that right?
Yeah, at the horse shows, we set up very, very fancy tack rooms every week with the curtains, and we set up a wood border and grass, and I mean, it's probably about $2,000 a week just to set up the shows that we set up at. And I was putting the curtains up, and I was leaning up against an old wood barn on the ladder, and a nail went right through my arm, and I got a really, really bad infection in my arm from it.
Yeah, it kind of a bizarre type of incident, really, when you think about it. And you mentioned the fast track that you were on with the show horses, really an Olympic caliber equestrian rider. How difficult was that on you, Kristen, when you finally realized that, hey, I can't do what I love anymore in that capacity?
It was hard. That show that I was at was a big CSIA qualifier, and that was right when I was starting to move up and do the Grand Prix successfully and have some nice horses. And I was just getting ready to go to the next level where I was going to be ready to start doing the international stuff. So, and that was always my dream. My dream was to go to the Olympics. I had a very, very nice horse at the time that eventually was going to turn into that caliber of a horse. So yeah, when that happened, it had to be that particular week. Timing was just horrible. It broke my heart. I mean, it was very, very, very hard on me. Yeah, I was pretty depressed, and I was on antibiotics for, 2 months for my arm, and I couldn't even straighten it. I mean, my elbow, it was swollen from my wrist all the way to my elbow, just huge. They had to lance it and everything and drain it. So, yeah, it hit me pretty hard. So that summer, I just hung around the racetrack just trying to get my mind off of things since I couldn't ride. And my jumpers sat around, and they got out of shape, and I never wanted to climb back on them again.
Did that time off, they say everything happens for a reason. Did that time off kind of give you the direction to maybe do something with racehorses? Is that really a catalyst for you?
It did. That was the summer that I hung out with John Sheriff, Felipe, who's now assistant for Richard Baltus. He was working for John at the time, and he kind of took me under. He knew me since I was a little tiny kid, too. And he started teaching me different things and just about the real racetrack life. So I started learning more from the farm life to the racetrack life. And I already knew legs really, really well from all the layups, hundreds of horses that we had come through the farm there. And I had a pretty good idea about getting horses ready because we were able to train there at the farm also. So between him and John, I mean, they just taught me the ropes of the racetrack, and then John finally kicked me out and said, "You're ready to go get your trainer's license," and I got it, and I had three horses that I had bought to actually be show jumpers. And I'll never forget one of them. I think I paid $1,000 for him, and he had screws in three out of four legs. He was a nice horse, though. His name was Brigade, and that was one of the first horses that I ran, And I originally just bought them to be show horses, and I made all three of them into race horses and went from there. That's when I started.
You said you were a tiny girl, you know, when you first came to the racetrack, and you were still pretty young, but I don't think people realize how young you were when you got your trainer's license. So it was it was kind of unprecedented at the time, as I recall.
Yeah, no, I was. It was a shock to me too. It was, and I remember I was flying home from the Belmont after War Emblem ran, and I was on the plane flying back and thinking about it, because John had told me the week before, I think it was right after I'd gotten home from the Preakness, that he thought I was ready to go take the test. In fact, I might have taken the first two tests before I left for the Preakness, and when I was coming home from the Belmont, I was taking the last test, and I was nervous about that. You know how that is. But
absolutely.
Everything went great, and got my license, no problem, and I was so nervous when I was taking the vet test. I didn't miss any of the questions. The only one I missed was, they asked me what you do if you have a sore foot. And I said, well, soak them with salt and vinegar and work on the foot. And they said, well, what kind of salt? I could not think of Epsom salt for the life of me. I mean, I knew what it was, but I was just so nervous. I couldn't think of Epsom.
I was so nervous when I took my trainer's test. In those days, it was only one test, but I was so nervous. I was pacing up and down, and my appointment was like at 10:30 with the stewards, and I couldn't stand it anymore. We were at Hollywood Park, and I went up to the press box, and in those days, they used to have a beer tap right in the press box. I poured myself a beer, and I actually drank a beer before I took my test to calm me down. I was a wreck. And yeah, I can't remember now what question I missed, but it was something equally as ridiculous. But I only missed one, too, but it's totally embarrassing.
You know, Kristen, crazy, you mentioned that John kind of kicked you out and said, hey, you're ready to go out and do this on your own. So he had a lot of confidence in you. Did you feel as if you were ready to go out on your own and make that move?
You know, I was a little bit nervous at first, but, I mean, like I said, I've been around horses since I was born. I mean, I showed my very first horse when I was 3 years old. And so I had the confidence as long as I was getting on the horses myself. And I'm the type of person, I learn by my mistakes. So I just figured, you know, they're my own personal horses. I'll just go and do it and make mistakes and learn from it. And I galloped the horses myself. I did everything myself. And, yeah, I was nervous. And I was nervous I was screwing up, especially when I had my dad breathing down my neck telling me I needed to work 2 7-eighths and 2 miles and then back them up to a half. I mean, and I had horses that all had problems coming off the racetrack, and I was trying to keep them sound at the same time. So trying to keep horses sound, trying to train that hard like he's telling me to do, that got a little bit tough. So, but everything got better when after I won my first race, and it just started to get in the swing of things and got a little more confidence and started figuring it out.
Talking with trainer Kristen Mulhall here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. It is, of course, Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton, which you can catch every single Wednesday night here on the network. Kristen, we talked about your dad not wanting you to be a trainer. Well, your godfather, Prince Salman, did approve, and he wanted you to go out and to train horses, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He didn't know at first when I had started training, and he heard through Jack, which was one of his bodyguards, told him when they were in England, and he had a fit when he found out. He called my dad. He got really, really upset, and there was a flight of 3 horses that were leaving that day from England. They were going to Richard Mandela, and he says, absolutely not. He says, I have to support her. Those horses go to Kristen. And Dad wasn't very happy about it, but Prince made it happen, and within 2 weeks, he had sent me 8 horses, and one of them ended up being my first winner.
How cool is it to be able to say that your godfather was a Saudi prince?
It's great. He was absolutely a great guy, and he passed away probably about a week or 2 weeks before my first win, which I wish he could have stuck around a little longer, but he honestly was... I couldn't have asked for anything better growing up. I mean, there was a jumper that I really, really wanted, and I was the type of kid growing up. I was always riding $5,000 horses and horses that have problems, and my dad was making me fix them, and you're riding a $5,000 horse against $300,000 and $400,000 horses. So I went to this auction, and there was this horse that was just, like, he was a dream horse to own. And I knew I'd never have a horse like that. So I was talking about him, and we were at the Pacific Classic when Crafty Friend ran. And the prince just was staring at me. He got this phone call, and he was just staring dead in my eyes. And kept saying, yes, 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 yes. Couldn't figure out what he was talking about. He hangs up the phone, and he tells me, go pick up my horse. He bought this horse for $110,000 through this auction. And that's kind of what got me going with my show horses and able to advance to the next level was getting that horse. So he was just a very caring guy and gave a lot to charities, people in need. He would see homeless people on the street, and in a limo he would stop and he'd pull over, he'd give him a couple $100s. And I don't think people really realized what a good guy he really was.
Well, I can imagine, considering the fact that he did pass away so close to your first win, that when you finally broke through with your first win, it had to be extremely emotional.
Yeah, I know it definitely was, especially because it was one of the horses he sent me. And who knows? I mean, who knows if he would have passed away a couple weeks earlier? I probably would have never gotten the chance to have those horses and train for him. But I wish he would have been able to stick around longer. It would have been fun.
He was a dream guy and a very loyal human being. Everybody that touched his life, he showed great concern for them. And I think sometimes that gets lost on a lot of people. You know, he was a bigger than life personality, but they didn't really realize the things he did behind the scenes.
Yeah, no, people definitely don't realize. I mean, you hear all different kinds of things, and him being an Arab and with the 9/11 thing and all that kind of stuff that went on, I think that kind of, it really aggravated me when I'd hear people start saying stuff about him, because he really never really met anyone quite like him. I mean, as giving and caring as he was, and all the way down to the horses and animals and dogs, everything. I mean, he's just a very, very nice man.
Kristen, you started this interview by talking about being able to break horses like Point Given and Spain and Oath, and that's just scratching the surface in terms of some of the great horses that came through that Thoroughbred Corp program. Put that into perspective for us. This was an organization and an operation that really had it rolling at that point in the sport's history, didn't it?
Yes, definitely, and it's something you'll never see again. I mean, it was pretty unbelievable to be able to walk down that yearling barn, and every single horse was a minimum of $200,000 was a cheap horse to them. I mean, you're talking about $400,000 or $500,000. There's probably 10 horses in each barn that were over $1 million. And just the quality of the stock, and we would break all the babies here in California in Bradbury, and then they would all, whichever ones were going to go to England to run, they'd go into the quarantine barn after they were broken galloping, and they'd ship off to England. But the quality of horses and just how smart those horses really are and how easy they were to break and handle versus the cheaper everyday horses that we have, it was quite a treat.
How long did it take you to know Point Given was special?
I knew it from when I saw him in Kentucky. I'll never forget the guy that worked at Milleridge. He brought him out, and my dad laughed at him. Everyone kind of laughed at him because he looked like a big old Clydesdale. I mean, he was just this big, awkward-looking yearling, tons and tons of hair. And the one of the guys that let him out, he told me, he says, this is going to be a champion. And he loved that horse from day one, from the time he was born. And I'll never forget at that time he was telling me it was going to be a rough winter because the squirrels were picking up all the acorns, and there was no acorns on the floor. How in the world did you know that? He said, oh, I'm telling you. And that was, it was a huge, huge winter storm there. And that's when they had the big ice storm and killed all the trees and everything. And that was the first time I saw Point Given. And he honestly was a big ham. I mean, at the farm in Bradbury, you could do anything with him. He was like a big pony. He didn't do a thing wrong. And then he got pretty tough once they trained him at Hollywood Park for a while. He got very, very, very tough after he ran first time out. That's when he started all the rearing stuff and being the wild man that he was. I think he just knew he was good. And he was smart, though. He would never do anything to hurt himself. I think he really was just playing with people. I saw him one day get loose at Santa Anita, It was the funniest thing I've ever seen. He ran around to one end of the barn. He stood there. He let someone get right up about 4 or 5 feet of him to grab him. And he took off and he ran to the other side of the barn and he did the same exact thing. He just stood there and waited for someone else to come up and catch him. Couldn't get him. He ran to the other side. But he would never do anything to really hurt himself. But your heart would be pounding.
Yeah, he was a pretty imposing horse, too, running in a little shed row at Santa Anita. I can imagine that was crazy. I hate to keep harping on the same thing, but you're a teenager when you're breaking these horses, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that goes to show how much confidence the prince had in you, right, buying all these horses, and you're taking care of them all. I mean, it's awesome. It's so cool. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm.
I think I was 13, 14 when I started breaking its first set of babies for him. And the one that I really remember. Well, there's two I remember. I remember Spain mainly because she was so small, and it was so, I mean, I felt like I was riding a little pony. She felt like she put her head down and you'd just go flying over her head. She was a tiny, tiny little thing. And then, of course, Point Given, just because he was special from day one.
As Lucas would say, a tribute to your program. I mean, these horses are, you know, household names, Hall of Famers, just incredible. And to think you were so young and doing all of that, it's really amazing. It's almost like a throwback, you know. We did a trainer talk with David Cross not too long ago, and he was talking about getting on horses in the morning when he was 8 years old and getting on two, going to school, coming back and getting on eight more in the evening before dinner. So that sounds like pretty much like your life, but it was like a 50 years difference in time.
Pretty much, yeah. No, definitely. Another horse we had too, the Cervicorp, another one of my favorites, the Sharp Cat. That was a great mare. And that mare, I spoiled her rotten, man. I hadn't seen her for 2 years, and I went to the farm in Kentucky to go see her, and she still nickered when she saw me and was whinnying at me for treats. So that horses are smart. They remember that. They remember people, and just goes to show you.
Kristen Mulhall, our special guest on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Kristen, does it help you today, having the experience that you had around those outstanding horses in your early years, does that help you when you're training horses in this modern era?
Definitely it did. The experience, I mean, it was a once-in-a-lifetime type deal to be able to be around those type of horses. And, it taught me a lot about the class level of horses, just being around them. And it was funny. You could see even the expensive horses. You could see the ones that had the ratty personalities and right off the bat, I mean, working with them, they were difficult, and those are the type of horses that never turned out and turned out to be cheaper claiming horses. So it gave me a pretty good idea of working around the young ones as to the horses that come in my barn, their personalities and the ability that they have pretty much.
You know, Jude keeps talking about how old you were when you were around these horses, and I should say how young you were, really, when you were around these horses. But you think back to your first graded stakes victory in 2003, and you weren't even 21 years old yet, and you had already saddled the graded stakes winner.
Yeah. No, it was, it was a great run. I had some very nice horses right off the bat, and it was mainly because of the prince and having that opportunity. I mean, if I didn't have that opportunity, I would have never been able to do that. You have to have the stock, obviously. But I had some nice horses, and I think the experience from being around the farm and the layups and the breaking the babies, and I mean, my dad turned me loose. He let me train them however I wanted to get them fit and ready to go to the racetrack, so I was able to learn that way as well.
It's interesting. He turned you loose with those, but then when you came to the track, he wanted to give you a whole bunch of advice.
I know, exactly.
Everybody
well,
knows
he never
two
wanted me
can.
To run a short horse. He wanted him to be overly fit. I think it's the old style of training, though. I mean, a lot of those guys were hard on horses, and they trained them hard and ran them often. And I mean, now we've got so much of the Stormcat blood in them and just a lot more speed and not as much durability, so we got to try and keep them together, that's more of the challenge, not really getting it's getting them fit and keeping them sound.
considering that you learned from John Sheriffs and worked for him for so long, what are some of the things that John taught you that maybe you're still using today, Kristen?
To be patient. You have a problem, back off. You're never going to get anywhere by trying to push through. I mean, you're going to get maybe one or two races out of them, and that's it. But if you're patient in the long run, you're going to have a horse for years to go. And I like having old horses around. I don't want to see him run for a year, year and a half, and be gone. I want to be able to see him when they're 6, 7 years old, still be on the racetrack and happy, sound horses. So he taught me how to be patient with the young ones. And basically how to work through issues, how to back off of a horse, yet keep the weight on them and keep them going a little bit so you don't lose all your fitness.
Are the young horses your favorite? Do you prefer that over or getting other kinds of horses?
I do like young horses. I don't love running them super early. I like developing them. I love distance grass horses. Well, probably one of my favorite things to have. And I love playing around with the cheaper claiming horses here and there. The challenges. I love a challenge. But no, I definitely would say I like the distance turf the best.
I would think with your penchant for fixing up old show horses that claiming a horse would be right in your wheelhouse, able to figure out what's wrong with them and make them happy and sassy again.
Yeah, no, I definitely love doing that. I got an old filly right now that she's kind of like the barn mascot, Sugar Spice. She's just a cheap claimer, but she runs every time that we put her out there and we put her in the right spot and we fix her up. And she's been a challenge. She was a very, very bad bleeder when I got her blood out the nose, and she hit her hind ankle all the way down to the bone. And we finally figured out she can't have front shoes. She has front shoes, she'll hit that hind ankle, and it's just very odd. I've never quite had a horse like her, but my blacksmith's done a tremendous job with her, and she runs barefoot all the time. And she, every time we run her, I mean, she puts out for us, but she's probably been one of the biggest challenges, but probably she's the most rewarding one, even out of the stakes winners and everything. You love to see her because you just know how much work we put into a horse like her every single day. And to see it pay off and see her be able to win, it's just a great feeling.
Yeah, that's a question that we often ask a lot of trainers. Sometimes it's not the stakes horses that are their favorites. It's a horse like that that tries hard and they've had to do a lot of work with.
Yeah, no, definitely. The ones like her that, I mean, in her mind, she's a stake horse. And she gives us everything she has every single time. And it's just those types that you work so many hours on a day. And to see it work and see it pay off, it's definitely the good horses. You just have to maintain them and keep them happy and keep them healthy, and they run. The cheaper ones, they're the harder ones to train.
Kristen Mulhall, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. We'll get to a short break. We'll come back with the second half of the program and maybe talk about a little horse by the name of Imperialism. I think you'll like that. Comes up next, Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Following a powerful sale in 2015, the Fasig Tipton Florida sale once again returns to Gulfstream Park in Hallandale Beach, Florida on Wednesday, March 2nd, with the Breeze Show scheduled for Monday, February 29th. The Fasig Tipton Florida sale was the only two-year-old sale in 2015 that sold two Grade 1 winning colts, including the Eclipse Champion Juvenile. Other Fasig Tipton Florida sale graduates include Grade 2 Futurity Stakes winner Annual Report, Grade 3 Jerome winner Flexibility, and stakes winners and promising three-year-old colts Awesome Speed, Jan's Reserve, and Shakamot, and the undefeated three-year-old colt Zulu, who is being pointed to the Grade 2 Fountain of Youth Stakes. 154 entries have been cataloged for this year's Florida sale, and you can download your catalog online now by visiting FasigTipton.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. to race the best.
Super Saver!
And to stand the best. WinStar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
And they're off to New York, the premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And now Imperialism is winding up, and Imperialism is going to come flying. Pink Sleeves on the outside. They turn for home. Lionheart, Quinton's Gold Rush on the inside, Hosco. But here's Imperialism coming like a rocket down the center of the track. Lionheart in front. Imperialism coming at him with each and every stride. Lionheart, Imperialism. Imperialism takes the advantage. Here's the wire. Imperialism has won the San Rafael. Concentrate was third, and Quinton's Gold Rush finished fourth.
Imperialism winning the San Rafael Stakes in his three-year-old season. That would catapult him to the Kentucky Derby for trainer Kristen Mulhall, and it was a very, very special event for her. We're going to talk about that coming up in the second half of the program, but do want to welcome everybody back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, visiting with Kristen Mulhall. And if you missed any portion of the first half of the program, well, all you have to do is go back to our website, horseracingradio.net, a podcast of this program and all of our Trainer Talk shows available for you right there on our site, horseracingradio.net. Really enjoyable first half of the program. Can't wait for the second half here.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Little trip down memory lane for me.
Yeah. So many of the moments and the people that you had a chance to be around when you were training in California, right?
Yeah, it was always fascinating to talk to Kristen's dad, Richard, about horses. He had some unbelievable stories, like the time he claimed Maxwell G and the time he ran a ringer at Caliente. I always wanted him to do a book, but he never would sit down with me long enough to get all the stories out. But he had some incredible stories.
Well, Kristen, it's part of the lore and the legend and the mystique of thoroughbred racing. And you talk about everything that you've experienced growing up in Southern California and being around the racetrack from day one. And here comes 2004, and here comes the Kentucky Derby. And at just 21 years old, you become the 11th female trainer to saddle a Kentucky Derby starter, and you would have been the youngest trainer ever to win the Kentucky Derby. We know Imperialism put in that huge late run. He comes flying behind Smarty Jones, but he ends up third in the Derby, and you had to be absolutely thrilled with the way that he performed.
Definitely I was. I mean, he had a lot of traffic problems, and it was a muddy racetrack, and I mean, he got plastered with mud, weaved in and out of horses. He really, really ran a big race.
What was that like for you, the whole Derby experience, being a young lady like that and having a horse that some people thought was, you know, a legitimate contender to win the Kentucky Derby?
It was pretty overwhelming. I mean, it was quite crazy. I'd been a little bit prepared, a little bit, because I'd been there the couple of years in a row with Point Given, and then again with War Emblem when Bob Baffert had them hanging around with Thoroughbred Corporation. So I kind of saw what it was like when he got attacked by reporters, but I never dreamed it was going to be the way it was once we got there. I mean, it was 24/7. Every time I was at the barn, I'd have 30 to 50 reporters just all around me. And if I wanted to get out of the circle, I'd have to get the security guard to come and get me. But it was definitely an experience.
You know, it's funny. I read a story that was on Blood Horse that year, right before the Kentucky Derby, and you said that you had a reporter come by and ask you if you would be available to do an interview one morning, and you told her that you had to train the horses during that time, and she had a very interesting take on why you should be able to do the interview, right?
Yeah. No, that was a different experience, but she, I don't really remember who it was for. Do you remember reading about it?
I don't remember if the reporter's name or organization was ever mentioned, but I do remember that she responded to you when you told her that you had to train the horse, and she said, well, Steve Taub owns your horses, right? And you told her yes. And she said, well, maybe we can just call him and get you out of work for a couple of hours.
Get me out of work. Yes, I thought that it would be easy to be able to do that. And Steve was quite crazy with the horse. And he would bring all the reporters the day before the Derby. Oh, my God. He had, like, three different female reporters over there. And he was feeding the horse donuts. And I turned around. I didn't even realize it. I turned around, and there he was with this girl trying to show the girl how to feed the horse a donut. And I ran over there. I stopped him. One of them was a chocolate donut, of course. And asked him how many he already ate, and he had already ate three donuts. Like, I wonder how many donuts he had fed that horse in the whole week leading up to the race.
Maybe that's the key. Maybe more people should run on donuts.
Yeah, exactly.
Steve, he's a crazy man. I trained for him for a while. He loves the game. He loves his horses, but he gets a little wild sometimes. It's a good thing you were able to rein him in just a tad.
Man, he was tough. But I think it was best when I had him, though, because I could wear him out a little bit. I would be on the horses, and Steve would be jogging by me every single second. So when I wanted to get Steve a little bit tired, I'd head down the trail at Hollywood Park, and he'd jog with me all the way down to the starting gate down the trail. Which is a good probably quarter mile of a ways, I'd say. When I'd train the horse, I'd come back up the chute and jog up the trail up the hill, and here's Steve. He would jog alongside of me again. By the time we got to the barn, Steve would be tired.
You know, so often in this game, Kristen, it seems like fate just takes its course and plays such a big role in so many key moments that we've seen in the sport. And I guess for you, it was kind of the same thing with the way that you ended up first being introduced to Steve and meeting him. Tell us that story.
I met him, the first time I ever met him actually was behind a vet truck. He walked up and introduced himself to me, and honestly, I'm horrible with people with faces. A horse, once I see a horse one time, I will never forget him. People, I gotta see him five or six times to remember their name. And I ran up to him in Clocker's Corner. I just worked a horse, and I ran up there to get something to drink or eat, and had dirt all over my face, and he was kind of laughing at me, and he asked me if I remembered what his name was. I was like, oh my God, and I really didn't remember it, but I just threw out there Steve, and it was the right name, thank God. And then he asked me, would you like to train a horse for me? I said, yeah, sure. And the next thing I know, I had three horses of his within the next week, and then he told me to buy him a horse, that he wanted to find something, and this little horse had just caught my eye all the time over there in Florida, and we called about him, and that's how we got him.
Yeah, the guy was a great soundbite. He had a quote where he said that you had the nose of Pinocchio when it came to snooping out a horse.
Oh, that's too funny. Well, that horse, I mean, I did a lot of homework on him, and we honestly, I mean, when we bought him, we were just looking for a nice, solid three-year-old. We didn't think he was going to be a stake horse or anything what he turned out to be. I mean, we were just hoping that we get a nice little allowance/overnight type stake horse, just something to have fun here in California with. But we started training him, and that's kind of where my show horse background helped me a lot. if I didn't do the show horses, I don't know what I would have done with that horse. But the very first time I got on him, I went to gallop him at Hollywood Park, and there's two gaps on the backside right there, on and off gaps, and a horse galloped by on the inside of him, and he made a right-hand turn with me so hard and galloped right off the racetrack, off the gap by the kitchen, and he almost dropped me. And he was just a roach to ride. He would make you turns. He had no mouth at all. So all I did with him was trained him in the chute, and I broke him. I completely broke him. Like, I probably could have gone to a horse show and won an under saddle class with him after 30 days. I got him to the point where he could figure eight across the diagonal, put his head down. He could do lead changes across the diagonal, just cantering slow. I mean, that was the best broke horse on the racetrack by the time I got done with him. And then I would just work him. So that's all I would ever do with him training-wise, is just take him down to the chute, and I'd hack him for 45 minutes to an hour. And honestly, we never planned on running in the San Vicente. We were trying to find an allowance race, and nothing would go for him. So I said, Steve, what do we have to lose? We put this blinker on him, so because he had a funny eye on him. It was completely, like, sunk in his head, and he would spook when horses would come up on him. We put the blinker on him, and I was able to get him comfortable with the blinker. At first, he would suck back. If horses would come around him, he could feel them, and he would suck back out of it. I said, the only thing we can do is take him back to last and have him running past horses rather than having horses around him and passing him, and maybe he'll get confidence and he'll keep going. So we put him in the San Vicente 7/8 at the time and told Victor to take him back, but, man, on the backside, I was a little bit embarrassed. I mean, that horse was so far back. And I didn't think he was going to be able to make up that kind of ground. And all of a sudden, he came flying, and he won easy, actually. And we were both quite shocked. We were hoping he'd hit the board, but he just really took to that running style, and that blinker helped him a lot. And I think getting him where he was broke to ride a little more, where you could maneuver him around and do what you wanted, made everyone's life a little easier.
So you buy a horse that's kind of a rogue with a sunken eye. What attracted you to him?
I had just seen a couple races that I really, really liked where he had come from off of it, and he had a powerful, powerful turn of foot when you get to the outside. And the other races, when he would lay mid-pack, he wouldn't fire. He wouldn't run that good. And I had no idea about his eye when we bought him, because I bought him sight unseen. I bought him just off of videos by watching him. So until he got to Hollywood Park that night, that was the very first time I saw that eye. And I really didn't know. I didn't know about the U-turns or any of that kind of stuff.
Well, sometimes you end up with a horse like that, and it's serendipitous. Obviously, you knew what you were doing. I can remember watching his turn of foot, and I think he has to rank right up there with some of the best horses I've seen at finishing. I mean, he just would level out and look like a freight train, literally. I mean, he really could finish.
He could. He definitely, as long as he took back and they made that one powerful run, he had a ginormous turn of foot. Just keep him in the clear where he doesn't get stopped, and he could really finish strong.
Kristen, he was kind of a throwback type of horse. And for a young lady coming to the Derby at just 21 years old, you had already had 15 starts under his belt by the time he got to Louisville. That, you don't see that very much anymore.
He ran a million times when he was in Florida. And that was another reason why I really liked him, just his hardiness, and he could just run. I mean, he stayed sound. When we bought him, he had an old chip in an ankle, and he had had the chip when he was a yearling. And it didn't bother me at all because he had run so many times. He didn't have any pressure in the ankle. I showed the x-rays to my vet. She said, I don't think it'll bother him at all. She said, I think you're fine, especially because he has run that many times. And I'll never forget when we went to sell him, I almost got in trouble. We went to sell him, and I was being honest and told the people that were buying him that he's got a chip in an ankle, but been there since we bought him. I've got the old x-rays if you want to see him. They went to x-ray that horse. He had no chip. The chip had dissolved. And they called Steve, and they went off on Steve and blamed it on me and told him that I didn't want to sell the horse, and I lied to him and told him that the horse had a chip in the ankle and he didn't have a chip in the ankle and that I'm not honest. And thank God Steve knew about the chip, because we were debating if we were even going to buy the horse. So Steve got mad at him and told him he wasn't going to sell him the horse anymore because I wasn't lying, and he was quite upset. And he didn't. He ended up not selling the horse to them, and we found someone else that ended up buying him. But, yeah, we went back through the old x-rays, and the chip had dissolved over time. It was such a small little flake. But he was just a hardy horse. He was sound from day one. Really never took a bad step on me.
Well, it's so funny. I talked about Steve Taub being a great soundbite. He had another one, too. When you think about being a throwback type of a horse like Imperialism was, he said the same thing about you, Kristen, where he said that if you watch National Velvet, you see Elizabeth Taylor as the sweet, cute girl with the horse. That reminds me of Kristen. She reminds me of an old movie. That was his quote about you right before the Derby.
Oh, that's so funny. Good old Steve. Yeah, no, he was around all the time. He watched everything, and I think it was the Breeders' Cup in New York, and we went to the movies to watch Dreamer when Dreamer first came out, and I've never seen Steve cry, and he was in tears in that movie. I kept looking over at him, and I'm like, what? And then we walked out of the theater, and he's like, do you not realize that was like your whole entire life story? And I started thinking about it, I'm like, oh my God, it was my life story. If you think about it, with the little girl, Daddy Prince, and fixing the horse that was sore, and then going on, and she went to the Breeders' Cup. I went to the Kentucky Derby. It kind of was my life story. Quite interesting.
Somebody stole it and made a movie out of it.
Exactly. Twisted it around a little bit, but it pretty much was how I grew up.
Visiting with trainer Kristen Mulhall on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Kristen, so describe your emotions and your feeling as you were watching Imperialism in the Derby, and he comes, I remember it was a sloppy track that day, Smarty Jones ended up winning, but Imperialism came flying home on the far outside. He gets past Limehouse in the final 16th of a mile to be a clear-cut third. Describe that race and what was going through your mind as you're watching it.
Honest to God truth, I never saw him till at the wire. It was so packed there, and we went and we were trying to find somewhere to watch. They take you up to the trainer owner area, and there was no TV, so then I wanted to run inside and see if I could watch it on a TV, and he was covered in mud by the time he turned for home. I could never find the horse. And then I saw him when he passed the wire, and he was third. So I really didn't even know what had happened until probably 15 minutes after the race when I got to watch the replay. And he ran huge. But it was crazy because I just had butterflies in my stomach the whole entire time. I could clearly see who was first and second, and then here he came.
That's great. Did you have to do any interviews before you actually saw the race?
A couple people were there attacking me, and I was just listening to Kent as to what happened, and he said he had a lot of traffic, and he was weaving in and out, and the only thing, he had never sat on the horse before the Derby, and the only thing we had said was just try and keep him in the clear, just try and take him all the way back, and then just get to the outside and let him just make that one powerful run, but don't try and get in between horses or around horses, because that's when he gets a little funny with that eye. And all the times, all the races when Victor had rode him, he had this huge, powerful turn of foot, but it was all on the outside. And I still think, if Victor would have rode him, I think Kent did a great job and everything, but I still feel if Victor would have been on him, he definitely would have been second, because he knew the horse, obviously, and the horse ran so well for Victor. I don't know if he would have ever beat Smarty Jones, but I do think he would have been second. Lionheart had never beat him before. And he just happened to beat him in the Derby.
Well, it was a very special experience for you. Of course, you would go on to the other Triple Crown races with him as well. And for you, Kristen, if people can't tell from listening to this program, it's obvious that it's always been about the horse, first and foremost, whether they've been one of your horses or somebody else's horse. And that brings us to the next horse that I want to ask you about, and that's a little horse by the name of Blues the Standard. Tell me a little bit about him and his story.
Blue is a great little horse. I had followed him from the day I started training, and he was a horse I always wanted to claim when he was running for $10,000. And I actually got out shook for him one time. I believe Mark Glatt got him back that day. And then he just started, he went through a couple other trainers, and Ted West got him, and he went up the ranks and got really, really, really good, ran the Breeders' Cup of San Anita, ran a huge, huge race, and then leveled off and started his decline. And I just felt bad for him. I didn't want to see him go back down that path, but he, unfortunately, he did. And he was going to run for at the bottom. And Osmond Cedeno was on him, who is my exercise rider. Still works for me to this day. And I just thought it was a little funny that top rider just went on him, and now all of a sudden they're putting Osmond on him, who doesn't really ride that often. And there was rumors going around that he wasn't the soundest in the world and he had some issues, and I just didn't want to see him get hurt on the racetrack. And he ended up scratching that day. He was a vet scratch. And then they were going to re-enter him, and they were threatening that they were going to take him to Arizona and run him in Arizona for the bottom. And I finally got a hold of the owner and begged him to retire the horse, and he didn't want to retire him. He felt that he had a couple more wins left in him, but he told me that I could buy him for $5,000, which was what they were going to run him for in Arizona. And I ended up buying him and brought him home. And he was a big ham. He had the worst reputation on the racetrack as this mean, vicious horse. He was ponied with a muzzle on all the time. And from the day I got him home, he was just the biggest love. I gave him about he had a basal sesamoid fracture when I got him. I ended up giving him about a year and a half off. And he bonded with my Great Dane out of all. And those two, you couldn't separate them. I mean, she would go out there, she would sleep with him. She never left his side. And he just turned into my big pet. Then I started riding him and got him real broke on the flat, taught him how to jump, had him jumping around little courses, and swapped his leads automatically. I mean, he probably, if he was sound, probably could have been a top level show horse. He was so smart, just did everything right, and he was a natural. I never had to teach him how to jump. I just pointed him towards the jumps, and he went. HRTV did a piece on him, and I'd never jumped a course on him in my life. And he just went around there and cantered 8 jumps in a row, did lines, did an in and out, did everything like he was an old pro. So he was just one of those horses that was good at anything you asked him to do.
Oh, what a great story. And a horse that, Jude, as you remember, second in the 2003 Breeders' Cup Sprint. And then here he is on the threshold of racing at the bottom claiming level in Arizona. And for Kristen to step in and give him a home, that's one of the great stories that people don't often hear about.
Yeah, well, it's so important, and I'm glad now people are paying a lot more attention to that. It's hard to find homes for horses sometimes, but it's now a situation where people are much more aware, owners are aware, they're beginning to be educated when they get in the game. It's not just owning a horse to race, but it's owning a horse, and you need to take care of that animal. And so it's stories like this that really help that situation improve.
Kristen, tell us about another horse that maybe we haven't touched on yet that, for whatever reason, is always going to hold a very special place in your heart.
God, I would probably say Porto Banuf. He was probably one of my favorites that I trained so far. I won some pretty nice long-distance turf races with him. He was a great, big, beautiful horse. He was by Supremo, who my dad trained for the Prince, homebred for Thoroughbred Corporation. Baffert trained him before, then he sold at the dispersal sale, and we were able to buy him at the dispersal sale. And he was nothing special at that time. He was probably a $40,000 claimer. And I got him long on the grass, and he just turned into a good horse. He had a huge, huge, huge heart. The San Luis Obispo was probably one of my most exciting races with him. He won it by a nose over a Frankel horse. I think it was continuously in Continental Red, and he just was a very, very, very nice horse, tried hard, and a big, beautiful, beautiful horse.
He was another one that you mentioned earlier. You like grass horses, and you know, there's something about having a nice grass horse that competes at that high level. It's just a whole different kettle of fish from running a dirt horse, even if it's a good dirt horse. What is it about the grass that attracts you to it?
Yeah, I like training them because it's a lot easier to keep one sound. You can work them a lot easier. I just teach them to run the last part of the race. And a lot slower work, longer work. Nowadays on the dirt, I mean, you got to run gate to wire. And it's just much, much, much tougher on them. You got to get them fit. You got to work them fast here. At least here in California, you do. You have to be able to handle the pressure. You have to be able to go 21-44 and keep going out here. And even our chief horses, they got to run every step of the way. Turf horses, it's not really that much. Turf horses, they really got to have that turn of foot and run the last quarter mile. So I really focus with them. It's my long gallops in the last quarter mile, 11 2-minute lift. And I try and teach them where the quarter pole is and where the finish line is. I want them to pick it up each ace. And that's just what I really enjoy doing, trying to teach a horse to have that turn of foot.
Well, Kristen, only a couple of minutes left here before we have to wrap up this edition of Trainer Talk, and have really enjoyed our visit here tonight. But before we go, what are some of the things that are still on that Kristen Mulhall bucket list that you want to accomplish in the sport?
I want to win a Breeders' Cup race. That would be very, very, very rewarding. I'd love to go back to the Derby. The Derby was kind of mixed emotions for me. It was a great experience. I had a great time. After the Derby, it was a little bit rough on me. I had quite a few followers and secret admirers, can I say, and lots of mail. And it got a little bit scary, honestly, people coming to my house, figuring out where I lived and that kind of stuff. I'm not quite sure if I'd ever want to be back in that spotlight again like that. But as far as I would love... Love to win a Breeders' Cup race.
That's a great goal to have. And now you've had some horses this year in Florida and California going back and forth. How's that experience been for you?
It's been good. I was actually thinking of moving to Florida with my main string. And then Ike Thrash contacted me, and he said he'd been watching me for a while and that he was planning on moving the horses to me this winter. And he didn't realize I was going to Florida and asked me if I would reverse my decision if he gave me all of his horses. This was right before Keeneland started up. And I said, yeah. I mean, how can you not take that opportunity? He's got some very, very nice horses. And after I had talked to him, he ended up winning the Queen Elizabeth with Her Eminency. And now I got all those horses. He's got a very, very powerful stable, so. I'm mainly staying out here in California for right now. I left the horses in Florida that were there in the summer. They're not really the stock that to compete there in the wintertime right now. So we're refreshing everyone and going to try and get ready for the summer meet there. And I'll send some more that belong there in the summertime that can do well and hopefully be able to win some of those races there and be strong here in California and all the stakes.
Well, Kristen, I have to tell you, it's been an absolute delight to hear your story and to hear some of your stories about your career. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, you're going to receive a gift from one of our sponsors. It's Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get those sent to you, and all the best moving forward with the Mulhall horses.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Kristen Mulhall here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Good stuff, JT.
Yeah, great show. Very interesting.
Yeah. Don't forget, if you missed any portion, go to our website, check it out, horseracingradio.net. You can also download the podcast on iTunes, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. For our producer back in our Lexington studio, that's Lee Delapina. For Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.